Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is Tuesday, August 22nd. We have today Danielle DiMartino Booth and Ira Harris. Danielle is founder and CEO of QI Research, which provides innovative leadership on how market intelligence is conceived and delivered. She's the author of Fed Up, an insider's take on why the Federal Reserve is bad for America, a business speaker and a commentator frequently featured on many media outlets. Prior to QI, Danielle spent 9 years at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, where she served as advisor to President Richard W. Fisher throughout the financial crisis. And Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, commodities, equities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently. Welcome, Danielle and Ira.
Thank you. Thank you for having us today, Richard. Good to be here.
Yes, Richard, this is another always an honor and a pleasure. This is a great honor and pleasure to be with Danielle. So I know we got lots to discuss. So
great. I thought we'd dive in, Danielle, with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets. So overall, from a high level view.
So I think the global economy, especially since you asked that question, is definitely slowing. We've seen some revisions to Germany's industrial production, for example, that would lead us to believe that Germany is going to see a third straight quarter of contraction. Of course, that's the world's third largest exporting nation. The United States industrial recession continues apace. When you net autos out of our own industrial production picture, you certainly see that very clearly, has been the case for more than a year now. And then, of course, China is slowing to a four-decade low level of growth. And a lot of this is predicated on the globality, as I call it, of the recession. Of course, the market has taken off for the races with its own narrative, kind of a dueling narrative here, that the United States is going to have a soft landing or no landing, and that it's going to be able to decouple from the rest of the world. So we've been here before. We've seen these episodes in the past where most of Wall Street comes together and forms a consensus that the United States as an economy is completely immune to what's going on in the rest of the world and even within its own cyclical domestic economy.
Very interesting. And your thoughts, Ira, in particular on the soft landing versus no landing?
You know what? I find this discussion kind of, you know, it's a Wall Street discussion, and they want to see it that way because, well, then I can stay invested in certain type of assets. I'm not good enough to be able to discern between hard landing, soft landing. I have certain indicators that I'm watching, which are trying to help me see through this. And again, you know, we have seen the rapid rise in interest rates, and everybody, you know, we stopped caring about Powell finding his inner Volcker because, again, that was, I'm not even sure what that meant, because as I've always maintained, Volcker couldn't find his inner Volcker with government debt at 105%. We would never have had that type of policy action, because the policy action would have brought the global economy to its knees, which it did anyway. But imagine if you had to finance all that government debt with a 16, 17, 18% treasury. It would have been, you know, he could do it because, you know, what was the debt to GDP was probably about 35, 36, 37%. So we've stopped doing that. Now we're talking about soft landing, you know, hard landing. There's so many things to play out. And as Danielle talks about, of course, with the role of the dollar. And, you know, if you listen to
still there, Ira? I guess while we wait for Ira to come back, Danielle, what are your thoughts on U.S. Federal Reserve policy, the trends in the central bank and interest rates?
Well, so, you know, I try and follow as closely as I can how certain members of the media, shall we say, are previewing Fed policy, because I find that to be have an uncanny correlation to how monetary policy plays out. So I just said that in a very diplomatic way. And, you know, if there's something that has been noted of late, it is that there is going to be more dissent going forward on the Federal Open Market Committee, and that is something we should be anticipating. And in addition to that, that the dot plot has shown that the 17 members, their view for the future is one that is higher for longer compared to what it was, say, 12, 18 months ago, given their responses to the survey that comes out four times a year for all of the members of the Federal Open Market Committee. So I think the narrative is one of they're going to continue trying to maintain a tightening stance headed into 2024. But by the same token, I think that Jay Powell is preparing, at least outwardly and publicly, for there to be a greater degree of dissent, which has really been a non-issue thus far in his chairmanship.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And in terms of the view on inflation and unsustainable government debt, do you see inflation continuing in an attempt to minimize or the burden of unsustainable government debt?
I think that that's certainly what we have been hearing about the stickiness of inflation. And while we've certainly seen gasoline prices go up quite a bit, and that really is what's been driving the train, we have to bear in mind that the largest single input into the consumer price index is shelter. And we are seeing the price of shelter, whether you're talking about apartment rents in particular, we're seeing that price come down at a very rapid pace. We've got purchase applications to buy a home, a weekly gauge produced by the Mortgage Bankers Association, at the second lowest level on record, almost matching its 1995 low. So despite this narrative that there's no inventory for sale, even on the new home sale front, we have seen the National Association of Home Builders come out and say that buyer traffic declined by the most in 10 months in August, which is indicative that it's not simply a lack of inventory narrative here, but that we should be prepared in the coming 12 months for inflation to be coming down. And that is certainly not what the consensus is advocating for. The consensus is saying that inflation is going to be sticky, pretty difficult to maintain that if your key driver here, again, is the very volatile energy input to the CPI when shelter is, 40% of the CPI, and it's coming down and coming down hard.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of the demand for U.S. Treasury bonds? Is it lacking from international buyers, like this indications from China they might be selling? What are your thoughts there? Like, will the Fed be forced to monetize the debt?
So likely not. You know, life insurance companies, public pensions, they are absolutely licking their chops right now. They've been waiting for a moment of real yields for as long as many of them have been in the industry. So we anticipate that natural buyers will step in to fill the void, if you will. And any notion that China might be even pondering divesting itself of its treasuries would be so catastrophic for the Chinese economy, for them to actually have to recognize and realize those losses at that juncture, given how fragile China is. No doubt it's trying to defend its currency, but of course its currency is pegged to the US dollar, so it can only do so much. But any notion And I realize it's extremely a sexy thing to talk about 2:30 a.m. on my Twitter feed. But any notion that the Chinese are about to start selling their treasuries would indicate that they were really going for a suicidal type of fiscal policy, and boggles the mind that it's something that even is raised. Will there be saber rattling? Is it fun for countries that want to see the dollar eventually fall to have very large, splashy international gatherings and talk about de-dollarization 24/7? It is, obviously. But until 87% of the $7 trillion per day volume currency market is no longer in greenbacks, and until countries like Saudi Arabia stop issuing their own sovereign debt in dollars, I think that, again, it's a subject matter that is much more well suited for the middle of the night on my Twitter feed than it is for actual conversation among adults.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira, on that, for the demand for...
Hey, I'm sorry. I cut out again. I've got a very unstable internet. But okay, this is a very important topic, and I'm glad Danielle covers it this well. And of course, we're seeing it play out with the discussion between Michael Pettis, who I guess we're doing a podcast with in September, and Adam Posen, and they're all picking up on this. But I caution people. If you listen to CNBC again, you think that China is over and we're going back to 1958, and it's going to be 100 flowers bloom, and it's just not like that. And China has to make a decision about how fast they're going to proceed. And I think because Xi is quite a bit different than, of course, his predecessors with Hu Jintao and Zhu Rongji, and certainly Deng Xiaoping, he's going to be a little more cautious here, because I think there are those in China who think a giant mistake was made in 2008, 2009, when Xi and others feel that they bailed out the West by ramping up their infrastructure spending and doing massive amounts of spending when the Western economies turned down. So they took on a lot of debt. So we don't know that the way this is going to play out, but I would caution the United States here, be very careful, because we just had a Camp David meeting between South Korea and Japan, which was, of course, a very important meeting to get them to sit down with the United States in just a three-way conversation. But if things are as bad in China as some people want to portray and believe that this is the end of the Chinese economic miracle, then China becomes, and this is just a hypothesis based on previous historical events, China becomes a little bit more dangerous. Because if they feel that they're being encircled, China will get dangerous. And the reason I say that is if we go back to April of 1979, when China invaded Vietnam because they thought that the Vietnamese were getting too close, now this is one of those ironies of history, to the Soviets. And China invaded Vietnam for three, and they stayed there for 3 weeks, and it was a very bloody affair. And yes, the Chinese lost over 50,000 troops. And then they pulled back, but they sent a very important message to the Vietnamese: don't get too close to the Soviets and think that you're encircling us. So I think the United States has to be very careful here, especially if you think that things are getting that bad, because just historically we know, and China is not the only one, when things start getting bad and then you start to look maybe outside for some adventures, then this becomes even that much more dangerous. So I would proceed here with great caution. And I'm not one who believes that things are as bad as China as others want to portray.
And Danielle, do you think there's a potential for the U.S. and also in Canada to look at registered accounts like 401ks, RIF, RSPs, IRAs, I guess, in the U.S. to force savers to apply a certain percentage of assets to purchase federal, state, or provincial government bonds to help the buying of the debt, in particular in the U.S. and Canada? Do you see the potential for that in the near future?
Well, we'd have to define near future, but I would say that if there was the potential for a blue wave in November of 2024, such that you had more of a command and control type of US government, that you could ponder such a hypothesis. As things stand right now, however, of course, we have a divided Congress. And on the right, we have some of the hardliners saying that they'd sooner see a government shutdown on October the 1st, at the same time that student loan repayments are going to be resuming for millions of Americans. So something of that nature, you could certainly ponder as a hypothetical, but not until and unless there was a blue wave in November of 2024 that brought in more people who would resemble Bernie Sanders in his style and advocate for more command and control. As things stand right now, however, I certainly wouldn't see this as being even a realistic potential development, given the current construct of our legislature.
Mm-hmm. Great insight. And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, it's another point that Danielle brings up. You know, it's, and I know Danielle felt the same way, and her knowledge on the debt ceiling battle was really just as usual, a sideshow. Everybody gets their time on the camera. As Warhol would say, they get their 15 minutes in front of the camera. But the debt issue coming back, as Daniel points out, this is going to be very serious. It's not the debt ceiling. It's the financing of this debt. And Danielle has spoken about this, and she knows as much as everybody, being at the Dallas Fed for those with Richard Fisher, who I would say was one of the better people at the Fed at that time, especially from the regional presidents. But the cost is already skyrocketing. And again, we're getting to that tenuous moment when the cost of the debt, the interest on the debt, is going to supersede the defense budget. And then decisions are going to have to be made. And they're going to have to be made going into an election year. And believe me, that's all, you know, the debates start when tomorrow, whatever, the Republican debate. So the focus is already there. And if the Republicans, to me, are smart, they will, in a mature way, discuss how to deal with this deficit, because this deficit is looming far larger. And you know, as other people have written about it, the piece that came out of the St. Louis Fed some weeks ago by Charles Calamaris on fiscal dominance. We're here. And I don't, you know, and I'm one of those who believe that the action that we've seen in the further out durations of the Treasury market are very much as Eddie Ardini spoke about in a Bloomberg piece the other day, talked about the return of the bond vigilantes. And for one, I'm glad to see the return of the so-called bond vigilantes, something that Rick Santelli has talked about for over 20 years, because it means that the impact from the Fed at this juncture is diminishing as they're doing quantitative tightening, and bond sellers can actually hold sway a little bit. I think it's very healthy for the markets, because one of the bad things about the bond markets is that all the central banks, the Fed, the ECB, the Brits, Bank of Japan to me is a different story, but they basically kept the bond vigilantes at bay, whether you like that term or not, because it was, you know, you want to talk about the widowmaker? We'll try to sell bonds into quantitative easing. That was a no-go. So I'm happy to see the return of it, because maybe people will become responsible.
And switching to a topic on the U.S. banks, we're talking before the podcast about Fitch ratings and the fight to maintain deposits on U.S. banks. Your thoughts on that, Danielle?
So I think that we are seeing in the Fed's data every Friday after the close, the Fed's H8 is reported, and it gives you a very timely weekly snapshot of what deposit flows look like inside of American banks. And while the Federal Reserve was very pointed about slowing the effect of quantitative tightening when we were in the heat of the debt ceiling debate and being prudent and kind of a good social citizen at that point, a social bureaucratic citizen at that point, we saw a reacceleration of the rundown of the balance sheet, which was reflected in other deposits and liabilities. And in fact, in last Friday's release, we saw other deposits in commercial U.S. commercial banks liabilities fall to the lowest level of this cycle. We have to bear in mind that the last time during the financial crisis that this was occurring, of course, the Federal Reserve was conducting quantitative easing. You actually were seeing other deposits increase at commercial banks, and this was something that added a cushion to the real economy. Right now, we're going in the opposite direction. In fact, at QI Research, we plotted out just a few days ago the movement year over year of job openings, and we compared that to the movement year over year of the deposit flow out of banks. And boy, if Chair Powell wants to slow this economy down, it's going to happen because banks continue to bleed deposits. And that's what Moody's was the first to come out and say they were concerned about. It might not be a bank run, but as my friend Jim Bianco says, it's certainly a bank power walk. And Fitch was the second to come out and reiterate its concerns about the banks. We have to bear in mind, it's not just an interest rate differential, of course, with their risk-free holdings, but also an interest rate differential on their risky loans in commercial real estate and in other types of loans on their books. And then just last night, we had Standard & Poor's come in as the third of the three major credit rating agencies voicing their concerns that even though we've seen the worst come and go with Silicon Valley Bank, we still did have the quiet failure of PacWest, and that whatever this episode is in the U.S. banking system, we've not yet seen or read the last chapter.
Your thoughts, Ira? Interesting.
Oh, I love this discussion, and who better to have it with? So yes, and as Danielle and I were talking about, you know, I was sent a piece yesterday that Beal Bank, which is in Texas, was offering 5.3% on a 3-month CD. Well, I bank at JPMorgan Chase for various reasons going back many, many years, especially after 08. But I've been trying to get them, and I threaten them, but they're finally paying. At least they offer me, because I'm in the private wealth group, a money market fund that is, climbing. We're not quite there yet. And I'm still better off in treasury bills. But I think Danielle's point in citing Jimmy Bianco, who I very fond of, power walk, it's interesting because I'm looking at, I have up in front of me all the bank stocks, right? And right now, another day down, even JP Morgan is well off its highs, Morgan Stanley well off its highs, Goldman Sachs, a lot of the regional banks, I'm looking at Synovus and New York Community, they're all getting hit here pretty good after they held, after, of course, the March debacle. They didn't hold. But one of the things that still plagues my mind is First Republic, because there was a darling of so many people, and that went from, $180 to zero in equity price. But why aren't we getting the same type of runs that we saw in March? Because when I went back yesterday and looked at this, I didn't know we'd be having this conversation, but I looked and TLT, which is, I'm a futures trader, so that's not really my first barometer to go to, but TLT back in March, on March 8th and 9th, was trading 102.5. We're down 10 or 11% from those levels, I believe, right? It's actually up a little bit today because the 30 years rally. So we're down 8 or 9%. And as Chris Whalen and others have pointed out, but certainly Chris Whalen and Danielle, over that these hold to maturity assets, which is really what became the most fragile point in it, because as depositors were leaving because they weren't getting paid anything, And then the banks had to sell off some of their holdings, and the hold to maturity all of a sudden became not hold to maturity, and they had to take big losses on it. These losses on the, it's like the banks, because the Fed stayed in that quantitative easing and at zero for far longer than I believe was necessary, and banks gorged themselves on a little longer duration because that's where they were getting higher yield. Well, these are now turning quite bad, but it seems like somebody is waking up to it. Well, my point is, where is the run that, and we know that the run was propagated through the social media aspect. And I know that, and I'm wondering whether the Department of Justice looked at, I'm giving them credit here, that they looked at who made the money on those short positions, because somebody got short the banks and then started that negative feedback loop. Why aren't we seeing that here? Has the DOJ warned certain parties? I don't know. Again, mere hypothesis. I'd like to hear Danielle's view on that. And I'll stop there.
Go ahead,
Danielle. I certainly see the banking regulators as wanting to avoid any even appearance of panic or contagion. And that's why I think the PacWest Bank of California deal was packaged as it was, to make it appear as if PacWest was the acquirer. So we certainly have a situation where the regulators are much, much more in tune to the different trigger points. But by the same token, we have seen one of the facilities that was created in the aftermath of Silicon Valley Bank at the Federal Reserve tick up very, very marginally. It's a $2 trillion facility. It's got about $108 billion pulled on it by banks, where they can go and get 100 cents on the dollar for some of these securities where they're holding these losses. But it certainly seems like the small increase in that facility that we've seen is indicative of much smaller banks that are showing distress. So I think that probably what the regulators would prefer to see would be very small banks, some consolidation to the extent that those marriages could be brokered without one entity taking too many losses of the other at the point of acquisition. But I do get the sense that regulators have a much better handle on the situation. And of course, it's in their interests, of course, to make sure that there are no more runs on banks. And one would think that they've beefed up their staff in order to ensure that that doesn't occur.
Well, if I may, Richard, so, you know, I think back, Danielle, and I know you were around, I hate to do this to you, but when Greenspan was able to get everybody into the same room, right? The 14 major players back in the during the Russian crisis of 1998, with Myron Scholes and that group, when they that situation, and Greenspan was able to line everybody up, and those were the 14 big players, you know. And as I said to one of my favorite, Kathleen Hayes, in 08, during the middle of the banking crisis, I said, because the dispersal of risk is so great now, you can't line up those players. You know, I laughed with Kathleen. I said, you'd have to rent out the Rose Bowl rather than put them in a room in a hotel, you know, because they're so, the risk factors are so diverse now. It's not like it was. So, but there are definitely things going on. I mean, I can see Morgan Stanley, which has been a darling and really has done a good job. And I'm not a fan of Jamie Gorman, but that's besides the point. But they've done a good job rebuilding their wealth management business. But even they've taken it a pretty good, you know, that stock a couple of weeks ago was at $95. We're down to 83.5 today. Something is definitely going on here that somebody is getting a little bit nervous about. And I don't know who it is. I'm just looking at what the market's telling me. I'm not a genius at this. I can look at a variety of stocks. And yet, unlike in March, the foreign banks, and I'll point to UBS, which I've promoted as a stock that I liked over the last couple of years on these podcasts. And the Japanese banks, they've already suffered so badly. But I look at, you know, other banks, they're doing better. But this is a situation, somebody is getting nervous about something. That's all, and trying to get ahead of it. And I don't know what it is, but I know from pricing in this environment, especially because the equity markets have really been pretty well behaved. Why are the banks all of a sudden? Yes, I know that their margins, their net interest margins, thanks to your work and the work of, you know, Waylon and others, you know, those are decreasing, but they were decreasing the whole time that the banks were putting on a rally post Silicon Valley and First Republic and Signature. So what are we seeing here? What is irritating this? And if it's so, I wish these Fed speakers that are, you know, if you want to see a crack up, it would be whether Chuck Schumer or any of the Fed presidents could get to a microphone faster. They need to stop talking so much.
And yeah, go ahead, Daniel.
I'm completely in agreement. Richard, if you want me to throw out my two cents here, I would simply offer that we have seen an acceleration in the pace of commercial real estate transacting. And if you're going to start to inch away from extending and pretending, then banks are going to be ratcheting up the pace at which some of these losses on these commercial real estate loans are recognized. In addition to that, I think people are realizing that Bank of America's staunch insistence that the U.S. consumer is strong is really being questioned when you have companies like Macy's come out and say, you know, we basically missed our numbers because the bad debts are going bad at such a faster pace than we had budgeted. U.S. households walking away from their obligations that we have to take down guidance. So, and we've seen this right in the charge-off levels at these big banks. And if you're going to have on top of this these commercial real estate transactions, the pace of them increased, then the market should be looking ahead and anticipating the next shoe to drop, and that would be corporate debt itself. And a lot of these collateralized loan obligations, and the fact that if we're coming into the ugliest, darkest days of commercial real estate, then the early movers are going to start moving on to the next area that's going to be flashing distress, and within corporation balance sheets.
Yes, interesting. A last question, perhaps on your thoughts, Danielle, on the Jackson Hole meeting in the next few days, like anything to expect from that, maybe what is likely to happen or be discussed or stated?
So, I've got a pool going right now. Does he make it to 9 minutes or not? Because he didn't make it to nine minutes last year. So, he gave a whole new meaning to succinct at the podium last year, and that scared the tar out of investors. In fact, Bloomberg over the weekend had a blurb that said there was $78 billion of net worth, of high net worth wealth that was blown to bits the last Friday of the Jackson Hole, because Powell was as brief and to the point as he was. I will certainly be looking to him to draw distinct parallels to distinguish between rates policy and that of the balance sheet, and to say as little as he can about the balance sheet, which he continues to maintain will be running off in the background, and possibly reiterate what's being floated around. And that's the possibility that the Fed begin to run something of a hybrid neutral type of Fed policy. I use the word neutral carefully. I'm not trying to speak to the neutral rate, but I'm trying to say the idea that has been floated by Dallas Federal Reserve President Lori Logan, a lifetime veteran of the New York Fed, who's now president here in Dallas. And it's been reiterated by Powell at the podium after the most recent FOMC. And that's the notion that if need be, we could start to see the federal funds rate come down in 2024, but at the same time have quantitative tightening, the running off of the balance sheet continue in tandem, such that one policy rail was effectively offsetting to a certain degree the other. because he wants to jettison from the toolbox for the future, which puts shivers down the spine of most people on Wall Street. He's decided that zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing are failed tools in the toolbox. He's got so much in the way of basis points to work with the Fed funds rate that he can use the 250 basis points that he used to get to the zero bound in when he stopped doing quantitative tightening last time, by the way, but he's got well more than the 250 basis points that he had to work with last time. When he did get to the zero bound, he could use 350, 400 basis points and decide to stop at 2% and have that be the new floor while he continues to roll off the balance sheet as an added bonus. You might see mortgage-backed securities prepayments pick up despite quantitative tightening continuing, and Powell be able to pull a third arrow out of his quiver and say, for all of the mortgage-backed security shrinkage of the balance sheet I was incapable of accomplishing because prepayment speeds slammed to a screeching halt, I'm going to go ahead and play catch up and let that portion of the balance sheet roll off, and I'm going to stop quantitative tightening on the Treasury side for now. I could envision something like this carrying through to 2025. But again, that really is Wall Street's worst nightmare.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great points there, insight. And your thoughts, Ira?
I love this. I love this. First of all, when I hear Danielle as a trader, and I'm leaning that way anyway, we're starting to see it, then I'm going to put on steepeners. And then the question is, how long will they let the steepeners run before we got some type of yield curve control, a la 1946 with the Fed Accord? So I don't know. It all depends how much damage they do. But I agree totally with Daniel on this, because he might try to pull that rabbit out of his hat, because then you'd have people roll down and actually shorten their duration on their mortgages, right? If I thought I could, if I knew that I would take an adjustable, if I knew that rates were actually going to come down while they continued quantitative tightening without saying it. Yeah, that's why I say they need to stop talking, because the more they talk, the more they paint themselves into difficult corners, because then they're always having to
faint deliver
in that way. And that's a very difficult situation, but they've created the situation for themselves, of course. And whether Wall Street wants, I could care not a lick about, because if I follow that way, as Luke Roman beautifully says, the rarest book on Wall Street that you can, the rarest book to find is a history book. They care about quarter to quarter, and we're so far beyond that right now, because of this policy that is prolonged. And we don't even bring up the ECB, which plays into this too, because this is a global phenomenon as much as it is a Fed. And the Fed conveniently likes to raise their global persona when it fits them and they have to open up swap lines, but they shy away from it and only talk about a dual mandate. But I've always seen it as a triple mandate, especially when you're the world's reserve currency. So I think Jackson Hole, and I loved it. Yeah, last year's speech was 8 minutes. Will he have more to say? I don't know. I'm not in that pool, but I don't know where. But the more they talk, and we're going to have three speakers this afternoon, the tighter that corner gets. And we're not even discussing yet that Biden has all these Fed governor appointees, right? We have Philip Jefferson, we have Lisa Cook, Goolsbee's at the Chicago Fed. We have the new appointee. So there's a lot of politics that are going to play out here. And Philip Jefferson and Lisa Cook are labor economists who will lean towards, I think, a softening approach. And I think we saw that in the last minutes that came out last week, by the way. I think there was a lot more dissension in that meeting than the unanimous vote showed. And there should be dissension, because you can't be a bona fide labor economist and not be concerned that you're going to over-tighten here, and it's going to be the workers who bear the brunt of it. And you're seeing it now with the UAW. Dean Baker put out a beautiful piece yesterday in which the head of the UAW raised the issue about 40% pay raises for the executives in the auto industry. Well, that's a nice bargaining point, and it needs to be considered. It needs to be considered, and I think this is going to tighten those types of conditions up. So there's so much here, and you know, Jackson Hole. You know, I'll take you back. When was that? Danielle will probably remember better than me. Back in 2020, I think it was at Jackson Hole, where Powell raised the issue of flexible, adjustable inflation targeting, right?
Yep. So,
when he said it, I said, this is ridiculous. The whole concept, who comes up with this concept? And Nick Timiraos, who I'm not a fan of, because I believe he sold his soul to be the horse whisperer. That's my opinion. That's not Danielle's or Richard's. And when you sell your soul, you stop doing real research. So I read the two contradictory pieces over the weekend and yesterday or today, not one discussion about the failure of the flexible adjustable inflation targeting. I mean, we heard about that, and then it's gone, you know, into the dust as it should have been, but they bring out things that they think will get some Wall Street favors at times when they need Wall Street. So I'm really anticipating, and then of course we have Lagarde on Friday afternoon. She'll be interesting because of course the ECB went to zero interest on mandatory reserve requirements at the ECB, which I thought was kind of interesting considering the Fed is nowhere near that. But I'm anticipating some fireworks out of Jackson Hole this week.
Well, it's been great discussion, awesome points. Danielle, how can our listeners learn more about your work and maybe a link to subscribe?
Of course, I've recently moved to the Substack platform, so please have a look, demartinobooth.substack.com. Would love to have you join the QI Research family. Just as off the rails as I am in voice, I certainly am in the written word on a daily basis, and we have a lot of fun entertaining and edifying our clients, and that's what our aim is. So love to have you join, and of course, follow me on Twitter if you don't already, at demartinobooth.
Yes, awesome. And Ira.
I really miss my blogging, but I'll get back to it. But I love doing these podcasts, and I get to sit with Danielle and people like Lacey Hunt and Rosenberg, and you get to discuss and really thrash out some of these things that you don't hear in a 3-minute interview in the mainstream media. And I know that's an important event, but the ability to thrash these issues out and really dig into them, I think, and I think Danielle does a great job of that. So this has been a great, opportunity for me, and I look forward to these opportunities because I think it helps me as much as it helps listeners, because you get to discuss in real time some serious things. It doesn't mean that you can trade them today, but you sure should put them on your radar screen and put them into your equations as to how about you're going to trade and invest going forward.
Great. Thank you so much, Danielle and Ira. Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.